the world tomorrow. In the face of today's energy crunch, radio and television commentator Garner Ted Armstrong examines our projected power shortages and presents our energy options of the future. And now, a look at energy. Here today, but gone tomorrow.
Energy makes our world go round. We live in a unique age, a time when Americans suck up and exhaust quantities of energy unequaled by any other civilization or time in the Earth's history. Our ancestors found a wilderness rich in wood, in coal, and oil, and they used it to make machines, which made more, until today, less than 1% of our work is done by human muscle. The United States, with only 6% of the Earth's population, consumes a whopping 35% of the world's energy. Each affluent American has at his disposal enough mechanical slaves to do the work equaling 500 human servants. We heat homes and schools, run our industries, build our cities, light our streets, harvest our crops, cook our food, power our 90 million cars and trucks, all with energy. Yes, energy has made us affluent and freed us from drudgery. Most of that energy comes from fossil fuels. In fact, petroleum and natural gas account for 75% of domestic energy consumption. Last year, Americans burned up some 6.3 billion barrels of oil and 25 billion cubic feet of natural gas. The only trouble is we're running out of the oil and gas that have become the mainstay of our energy supply. In preparing this program, our crew talked with representatives from industry as well as governmental officials from ERDA, the newly created Energy Research and Development Administration. All of them agree that the energy crisis is one of the most potentially devastating problems to ever face the American people.
We're talking with Mr. Frank Murray from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Mr. Murray, are we facing a long-term energy crisis, or is this problem simply a temporary inconvenience?
Well, I think this is one of the things that the general public hasn't quite come to grips yet. We have experienced a fundamental change in our basic energy picture, in our ability to meet our own energy requirements. And the public has not really, I don't believe, recognized the fundamental nature of this change and become willing, I think, to accept the necessary changes in their lifestyles, inconvenience, and possibly even some degree of hardships to cope and to deal with this type of problem. So I think it is a fundamental change.
This is Dr. James Liverman, Federal Representative for the Energy Research and Development Administration. Dr. Liverman, Americans perhaps are pretty much, in one sense, energy illiterates. Have Americans as a whole grasped, in your opinion, the seriousness of the energy crisis itself?
I wish I were persuaded that we're illiteracy that's the problem. I think apathy is a better description. I'm comfortable. I don't want to be made uncomfortable, and therefore I don't want to make any personal sacrifice. You can make it, but I don't want to. That seems to convey to me the attitude of a lot of people. Next household can turn their thermostat up or down, but lets us be comfortable. So if we could cure the apathy problem, which is much more difficult than illiteracy, I think we'd be a lot further down the road. But we must, I think.
Have we run out of lead time?
We don't have any time left. We're going to have to hit every energy source that we have and utilize it as rapidly as we can and conserve as much as we can in order to keep from digging ourselves in a deeper hole.
It's incredible how dramatically the world has changed since the Yom Kippur War and the Arab oil embargo. Back when we first heard words energy crisis, we were only dependent to the point about 24% on Arab oil. That's about 1970, that statistic was true. Then today, we have come all the way to 38% dependency upon imported Arab oil. So instead of getting off being hooked on imported oil from OPEC countries who have a scimitar at the jugular vein of the developed Western world, including Europe and Japan, we have become ever more dependent upon OPEC oil. As a matter of fact, about three-quarters of the known reserves lie under the countries that are members of OPEC. You know, that translates into some interesting statistics as to what it costs us. We today in the United States, despite our search for alternative energy sources, are spending $24 billion a year on Arab and imported oil. That translates into $2 billion a month, $78 million every single day, or if you'd like to put it another way, we spend in the United States $1,000 a second for Arab oil. So we're becoming more dependent, not less so, as we continually hear all the publicity about alternative energy sources. You know, someday this gigantic, complex technology of ours may simply come grinding to a halt when we pull the switch or push the button and then nothing happens. I'm sometimes amazed at the short-sightedness and apathy of many of the American folk when it comes to the energy crisis. When you talk to people, many still believe that the entirety of the energy crisis is contrived by some of the big oil companies only as a gimmick to raise prices. There are many people who simply do not believe this world is facing shortages of some of the vital raw materials, from metals to some of the energy sources we need. Well, today, whether we like it or not, whether we want to believe it or not, we do face serious energy shortfalls. Many parts of the country in any given period of a severe winter would experience that almost immediately. Now, there are three possibilities that we're dealing with right now. We can do about it one way or the other. The first is simply face the use of less energy in all of its assorted forms. To a degree, we're already doing that. We've had to turn down many of our home thermostats. We've had to experience the same thing in public buildings. We're using less electrical energy. We're reminding ourselves, whether in hotels, motels, or at home, to do so. The consequences, however, have been somewhat minor. We have not experienced any real nationwide energy shortages or less use or dependence upon our energy sources. We have simply gone on as if there is no such thing as an energy crisis. The second alternative is to import more foreign oil, and we're already doing that, too. As I mentioned earlier, 38% dependency right now today, and that ever more increases our vulnerability. It increases not only the potentiality for additional unacceptable price hikes, which you can expect, but it also increases the vulnerability to a future oil embargo. And in the van of the UN resolution, which decries Zionism as a form of racism, you can well expect that the Arabs would be only too eager to use with alacrity their oil as a political weapon. Some future Arab oil embargo is quite likely. Thus, our vulnerability increases, as well as our dependability, hand in hand at the same time. Another alternative is that we've discussed from time to time of developing our own alternative energy sources. And we're doing this in many areas, nuclear, geothermal, and of course the search today that is literally tearing apart the landscape and sometimes the tempers of many people in our western states of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and many others that are experiencing environmental impact studies and the resulting press as a result of trying to strip mine the coal that is there and to get the oil out of shale. So it's a big question, and it's going to be with us for a long time to come. The amazing thing to me is the short-sightedness and the apathy, the unwillingness of many an American citizen to believe there is such a thing as an energy crisis in the first place. It reminds me of the elderly couple driving along the highway. She says, "Henry, aren't we about to run out of gas?" And he says, "Nonsense, Martha. We're still going 70 miles an hour." Energy, here today, but gone tomorrow.
Alexander Petrovich, Russian army officer, spent 4 years in Cairo, Egypt as a tank corps advisor. Eric Kaufman, industrial planner involved in automobile marketing in Hamburg, Germany. Charles Tex Williams, vital materials import manager for a major international firm based in Galveston, Texas. Hiroshi Omoto, management trainee at an international toy marketing firm in Osaka, Japan. Though all from different cultures, speaking foreign languages and having varied occupations, these men share a common interest: oil. What's behind the energy crisis? Solving it will take international cooperation and individual effort. You want to know why this crisis exists and what you can do about it personally. Request your free copy of What's Behind the Energy Crisis. There's no charge or obligation. What's Behind the Energy Crisis? Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Coal is a prime candidate for meeting our future energy needs. Truly staggering amounts of energy are locked up in U.S. coal deposits. The United States has 1.3 to 2 trillion tons of coal, of which 390 billion tons are considered readily recoverable. The energy in U.S. coal is twice the amount of energy in Middle East oil. At current levels of consumption, the U.S. has nearly a 1,000-year supply of coal. But coal is bulky and expensive to ship, It requires large storage facilities, and much of it is high in sulfur and other impurities. Moreover, despite extensive research, scientists have not yet found a truly reliable way to cleanse the stagnant gases of coal-burning electric generators. Attempts to convert coal to oil and gas have been partially successful, but many problems remain, and the cost of such new technology can be enormous.
We're talking now with Dr. William Gauss from IRDA, that is the Energy Research and Development Administration. Dr. Gauss, the gasification of coal, that is turning coal into a synthetic natural gas, can it be economically done?
It can be done. Economics is relative. You can't do it for today's price of natural gas. But when you need it and there isn't any more natural gas, it'll be economic by definition. But it'll be considerably more expensive than today's natural gas prices. Well, if you want to build a coal gasification plant, if that's what you're talking about, we're estimating now that a commercial-sized installation would be more than $1 billion, maybe $1.25 billion, which is a great deal of money, or even General Motors or Exxon.
Strip mining has been attacked as a threat to the environment, that is scarring the land and disrupting the ecology. Is there any reasonable coal mining method that could keep coal mining under the ground?
Well, you can deep mine coal, it just costs more. We're going to take the surface coal because there's no reason why you can't strip mine and have an acceptable restoration reclamation process in most parts of the country. There is a period of time when you're interrupting things while you're actually doing the mining. There's no way to avoid that. But if you plan for the reclamation at the beginning, you can handle it reasonably well.
Has that been a proven fact?
Well, it depends. I just came back from a trip out west, and some of the land that we're stripping, I don't think you can tell anything's been done to it, whether it's stripped or not, except if you see it happening. It's desert with nothing there before, and it's desert with nothing thereafter. Now, there are other parts with nice grasslands and forests. You'd have to put it back to grassland and forest, but you can't. Trees grow back. There's a period when they're gone, but they do grow back, and as long as you plan for it, you can. And the total amount that you disrupt at any one period of time would be really insignificant. Most people would be unaware that it's happening.
So you would justify strip mining?
Sure, as long as you put the appropriate set of regulations on the process to make sure things are restored.
Of course, the environmentalists would say we're raping the land.
Well, sure they would. That's their privilege.
But you would not agree with this?
No. We rape it every time we plant crops. We're just used to that kind of rape. Which is the faster time scale. The crops grow in 1 year and forests take 20.
Do you see the day of, quote, King Coal, unquote, returning?
Yes, I think he's already back in terms of the next 15 to 30 years. I think we could quadruple coal by the year 2000 if we made it a national policy. And if it became clear this was going to happen, it takes a long time to do that. But if you took nuclear out, you'd have to not quadruple, but maybe 8 or 9 times by the year 2000. That's a job I don't like to think about.
Nuclear fission also holds promise. Already, 56 nuclear plants generate over 8% of the electrical power in the United States. 1 pound of uranium fuel as it goes into a nuclear reactor with present technology will supply as much heat as 50,000 pounds of coal going into a coal-burning plant. Proponents of nuclear power claim that nuclear-generated electricity is also less expensive than electricity generated by fossil fuels.
Mr. Murray, where does nuclear energy rank as an alternative energy source in comparison with fossil-type fuels?
Well, basically, nuclear power, in this country anyway, is used strictly for the generation of electrical energy. This, in some degree, limits its applicability, particularly to the current economic system which we have, with its basic set of investment in consumer and industrial goods that use other types of fuels other than electrical energy. So it has limited application, as we see it now, in relation to fossil fuels in particular. In the long run, if we evolve into a higher and higher use of electrical energy for more and more things, and of course nuclear can play a greater and greater role. Of course, the problems with it are generally known, as are the problems with the fossil fuel, so one has to trade one against the other.
Opponents maintain that the dangers from reactor accidents, radioactive waste, and nuclear terrorism preclude the widespread reliance on nuclear power. Yet, if the dangers and risks of nuclear power can be overcome, it may provide much-needed electrical power in the future. Even if we can avoid or minimize the hazards of nuclear energy, we may find that, like oil and natural gas, we're running short of uranium. The troubling fact is that no new major uranium-producing areas or potential producing areas have been identified in this country during the past 17 years. Yet, based on current estimates of the number of nuclear plants we will require, we will need to find from 4 to 8 times as much uranium as the present U.S. total of proven reserves. To circumvent this problem, research is going ahead on the breeder reactor, which could use the 99% of the uranium that is presently unusable in conventional reactors. The breeder could convert abundant uranium-238 into prodigious amounts of plutonium, which could be used to generate more electrical power in these first-generation reactors. But then we face the potential dangers of plutonium. Plutonium is not only extremely radioactive, it's also used to make atomic bombs. So far, the controversy over the risks of nuclear power has not been resolved. After coal and nuclear power, there are still a large number of possible energy alternatives to oil and gas, but these energy sources are future possibilities, not present realities. Fusion energy, the power source of the sun, also has great potential. The combining of atoms in nuclear fusion produces only mildly radioactive materials, and the raw materials necessary, primarily heavy hydrogen, are copiously abundant in the world's oceans. In theory, there is enough energy available in 1 gallon of seawater to equal that from 300 gallons of gasoline. The problem is that in order to get fusion to take place, hydrogen atoms must be heated to more than 100 million degrees centigrade. Such temperatures are found in the stars, but no container can be made to withstand such temperatures. Scientists are thus trying to perfect magnetic bottles to contain the fusion reaction. So far, some success has been achieved, but progress has been slow. Yet, man may eventually succeed in creating a controlled mini-sun on Earth and thus tap what is often considered the fundamental energy source of the universe. If so, mankind will have a virtually unlimited source of clean power that could last for 10 billion years.
Mr. Murray, again, based on your findings at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is controlled nuclear fusion a likely prospect for energy in, say, the next 25 years?
Well, the fusion energy is really in its infancy. The basic theoretical demonstration, or the basic demonstration of the theory, has not been proven and sustained, even under laboratory conditions. And I think from that one must conclude that fusion power in a commercial sense is many years away. Probably one really ought to think in terms of decades rather than years.
Solar power is perhaps the most commonly cited alternative energy source. Solar energy is free, it's available in every country, its technology is understood, and it's clean and safe. It has no political overtones, there's no way to steal it, cartel it, or even to use it up. The power of the sun's rays is enormous, averaging about 1 kilowatt per square meter of surface. At high noon, on a clear day in June, the sunshine falling on New York City is the equivalent of the energy produced by all the power plants in the entire world at peak performance. 3,600 billion BTUs are thought to reach the surface of the Earth each year versus 1 billion BTUs that are projected to be needed in world consumption by the year 2000. If only 0.2% of land in the United States were equipped with conversion devices capable of a 10% conversion efficiency, the total U.S. demand for electricity could be met. Solar heating and cooling programs could save the equivalent of 1 million barrels of oil daily by 1985. This is because more than 80% of the average homeowner's energy bill is for heating, cooling, and hot water, accounting for 1/4 of the energy consumed in the United States. Yet the challenge is to come up with cheap and reliable systems So far, solar energy has found only very limited use because its cost has simply been too prohibitive.
We're speaking with Dr. George Lerf, who has worked for over 30 years in the field of solar energy. Dr. Lerf, can you give us some idea of how much it would cost to outfit the typical American home with solar devices?
In round figures, very round figures, let's say a three-bedroom house in a reasonably sunny climate. Something today, our company, for example, would typical contract for installation will be in the $8,000 range. I would say that when volume production is achieved and economies due to bulk manufacturing and purchasing arrive, it'll be more like $5,000. And with that kind, with those capital costs and the electricity at 3 cents a kilowatt hour, you can save those costs in less than 10 years.
With us now is Mr. Don Beatty from the Energy Research and Development Administration. Mr. Beatty, is the conversion of solar energy into electricity more costly than use of fossil fuels?
In general, yes. The first costs, or the capital costs of a solar system, will be more expensive than a fossil or a nuclear plant. And the reason is that the energy that you are trying to capture and convert to something useful is rather diffuse, very diffuse. And so as a result, you must have large collectors covering a large amount of land in order to make a big impact or to collect a lot of energy, and that costs money.
So the primary limitation for solar energy remains its cost. With further development, hopefully these costs can be markedly reduced. In 4 years, federal funding for solar energy research has gone from less than $1 million to more than $100 million. In fact, the Energy Research and Development Administration had a fiscal 76 budget of $144 million for solar research. But even with lavish governmental support, experts caution that it will be many years before this energy source accounts for any appreciable portion of the nation's need. Wind-generated electricity is being reborn in certain areas of the country where wind velocities average 15 to 20 miles per hour. This generally occurs in coastal regions, the Great Plains, and on our northern border. Hill and mountaintops are also likely locations. Huge 100-megawatt systems are being planned, requiring 50 to 100 windmills on 50 acres of land. The primary difficulty is that wind is intermittent, hence the need for suitable storage devices for the generated electricity. Whether wind can make a significant contribution to our energy needs, however, remains to be seen. Geothermal energy is another bright prospect, especially west of the Rockies. Already, dry steam from the Big Geyser area north of San Francisco is generating the equivalent of half the city's electrical power. Hot rock technology is also being explored in other parts of the southwestern United States and in other parts of the world. Other more exotic energy alternatives also exist. Tides, ocean thermal differences, and biomass fuels may be utilized for tomorrow's energy needs. With a good measure of luck and hard work, alternative power sources may provide the ultimate answer to our energy needs. But time is short.
Mr. Beatty is a member of IRDA, that is the Energy Research and Development Administration. Can you comment on the prospects of some of those more novel forms of alternative energy? First, how widely can wind generators be employed?
Quite widely. We are in the process of making a wind resource survey of the United States at this time, but there are large areas of the United States that we feel have good average winds. And in particular, there are areas on the West Coast, in the Great Plains, near the Great Lakes, parts of the East Coast, where the average winds are high enough to allow us to produce power economically by windmills.
How great a contribution can geothermal energy make as an alternative energy source?
Well, we feel that by the year 1985 or 1990, we can expect to have perhaps 15 to 20,000 megawatts of power online from geothermal. At the present time, the total capacity in the United States is just a little over 500 megawatts. So that's a rather sizable gain. Perhaps as much as 100,000 megawatts by the year 2000, if all of our technologies work out. And based on the projections that have been made of our electric generating capacity, this could be anywhere from 5 to 10% of our total electric generating capacity.
How would you rank ocean thermal power?
Well, first of all, ocean thermal differences were used in 1929 to make electricity, so it's a technique that we know works. Unfortunately, to do it in an economical fashion, again, as in most of the solar technologies, needs a very special technological mix which will collect this rather diffuse energy. We're only talking about perhaps a 30 degree difference in temperature and convert it to something useful. So we're talking about some new binary cycles. We're talking about special pumps. We're talking about floating platforms or nearshore platforms of a very large size. All of these things have to be put together. The stickiest question of all on ocean thermal is the heat exchanger. All of the solar technologies we know work. There aren't any of these that don't work or haven't worked in the past. But the whole question is one of economics. How can we get these systems to work in competition with lower fossil fuels, lower cost fossil fuels? And all of our programs are aimed at reducing the cost of providing these systems.
Well, what is really happening today is quite an intensive search for the development of our own alternative energy resources. It seems somehow ironic to me that as we approach our bicentennial celebration, a free, strong, proud, independent America, wanting to be independent from other countries and to go our own way in the world, that we are instead becoming more and more dependent upon countries increasingly hostile to the United States and our allies. We are now almost totally dependent on Arab oil. I don't mean 100%. I mean dependent because if they cut it off, our entire vaunted technology might come screeching to a calamitous halt. Arab oil, vagaries in price hikes and future embargoes can literally throw millions of Americans out of a job, impact therefore the entirety of our economy and our big institutions. And now, today, we must take into account, in the entire foreign policy procedure, in the entire international monetary picture, and the financial and economic picture of the entirety of the world, as well as our own defense posture, what the Arabs say and think and do when it comes to American policy in the world at large. Well, the time to act on the energy question is now. Not yesterday, and not even tomorrow, but right now. Instead, millions of Americans seem to be pretending there is no such thing as an energy crisis, and instead of reevaluating the entirety of our way of life from top to bottom and wondering whether we should keep all of our mechanical toys, we continue to play the game of hide our eyes from impending reality and seeking our own personal pleasures, and probably we're driving an automobile while we're doing it. There won't be any time left for experimentation with alternative energy sources when all the oil is gone. And the day when that oil is gone is inevitably approaching. Energy. Here today, yes. But gone tomorrow?
You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Plain Truth. This international journal of understanding comes along every month with a penetrating analysis of world news in the light of Bible prophecy. Your subscription is free of charge. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, brought to you by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales.